Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. Today, it's open lines for your questions and your comments. During open lines, it's always anything you want to talk about, although I will occasionally lay a subject on the table for discussion, a question or a comment. We've got news to share during this final hour of the program today. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Talk a little bit about Islam here and whether or not Christian evangelicals are just blowing an opportunity for evangelism among Muslims by aligning themselves so closely with national Israel. I mean, we talk about being seeker sensitive. If we consider the Muslims' prospects for evangelism and we don't want to put up any barriers to the gospel, I mean, how often do we hear this? We don't put up any barriers to the gospel. What are American evangelicals who seem to be earnest about evangelizing everyone, including Muslims, what are they doing putting up a barrier to the gospel by aligning themselves politically and sometimes even religiously with national Israel? A couple stories to share with you in that regard. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And according to a judge in Colorado, the Bible, while a magnificent book for navigating life's dilemmas, should not bear upon a judge's ruling. We'll talk about that. And did you know that under certain conceal and carry laws in Minnesota, I'm talking about gun control again, conceal and carry laws, you could carry a gun into a church parking lot? There are even guidelines being put forth by churches up there about what you do if someone shows up in church with a gun. Now, I know we've talked about this before. Conservative Christians often have a hard time sorting out the Constitution from the Bible on gun laws. And I say this again as a gun owner. Would you draw the line at carrying the gun to church? But why use a gun? Here's a story from Maine I'll get to in just a few minutes. A Lutheran church up in Maine, they didn't use a gun. They used coffee. Apparently, there was a conspiracy uncovered among church members to poison the church's 12-member council using the coffee, not making it too strong. I mean, you've had church coffee before, haven't you? It might taste poisonous, but this had actual poison in it. That story in a few minutes. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And I guess there are a few questions in there as well. Here's a story from, this is from Newsweek, MSNBC's website as well, Howard Feynman and others write, mixing Churchill and the Bible, Tom DeLay talked, and this is Representative Tom DeLay, talked about a destiny shared by America and Israel. He asked for divine assistance in protecting both. And in closing, and this is in remarks he made regarding the death of the astronauts in the Columbia disaster, one of whom was a national Israeli. In closing, to the astonishment of his audience, he recited in Hebrew the last line of the Jewish prayer for the dead. Now, remember, Tom DeLay is a Christian. The crowd, many in tears, joined in. It was quite a moment, said Jack Abramoff, a lobbyist. Quite an understatement, the article goes on to say. Though they welcomed him as an ardent supporter of Israel, many in the audience at the Republican Jewish Coalition Conference were wary of DeLay's view on a host of social issues. He's pro-life, anti-gay rights, pro-voucher, pro-gun, pro-school prayer. You're kind of typical, I mean, this is what would be, I mean, I don't think it's unfair to say your typical religious right. I think Tom DeLay wears that banner rather proudly, doesn't he? Nor are they fond of his occasional declarations that what America needs is more Christians in office. Some would argue, quote, that it's a mistake for Jews to get into bed with the religious right, said Jess Hordes of the Anti-Defamation League. But Howard Feynman says, too late. Indeed, these bedfellows aren't strange anymore. Which President George W. Bush with a new opportunity and a new risk? Opening another front in his war on terror, the president has launched an effort to coax Israelis and Palestinians toward peace. You've heard of the roadmap, haven't you? As Bush prepares for his trip to the G8 summit in France, there's talk that he'll tack on a trip to the Middle East. But the roadmap he wants to pursue there runs not only through the Byzantine byways of the Levant, but also along the political freeways of America. If he is serious, Bush will eventually hit a potentially impenetrable roadblock at home, the deepening alliance between Jewish supporters of Israel and the growing ranks of what Feynman calls Christian Zionists. Now that's the political take on the president's roadmap for peace in the Middle East. In other words, the roadmap is going to require compromise on the part of Israel. Compromise not only in ideas, but perhaps even in territory. There's no mistake about this. The roadmap for peace says peace will be bought, at least from the Israeli side, with concessions, and those concessions will take the form of land. Or at the very, very least, which I find impossible to imagine in the future, at the very least, taking no more land. Just staying where they're at. I don't think that's going to satisfy anybody. That's the political side. The president will eventually run up against Christian Zionists. In fact, I was listening to the radio last week to a discussion of, I think it was the roadmap, and someone asked the question, now look, there are voters who voted for George W. Bush who believe firmly that every last square inch of the ancient boundaries of Israel, the Old Testament boundaries of Israel, belong to Israel today, and that anything less than that is an unacceptable compromise on the part of Israel, on the part of American policy. So the president will run into a roadblock there eventually. I think Feynman's not, you know, he's not announcing anything earth-shaking here. But I've got a question that has to do not with the president or foreign policy, and nothing to do with Tom DeLay, except for the fact that he is a Christian, and a Christian evangelical. Christian evangelicals, we must credit them with one thing. Talked recently with Craig Parton. He said, look, there is missionary and evangelism zeal among Christian evangelicals. No two ways about it. I think Parton said they want to preach the gospel to anything breathing. And that's good. But doesn't the Christian Zionist affinity for national Israel not only stand in the way of the president's roadmap for peace, but also in the way of evangelism to Muslims? Isn't the Christian Zionist, if that's what you consider yourself, aren't you really faced with a choice between irreparably offending, not with the gospel, but with your support for Israel, irreparably offending Muslims who view support for Israel as de facto anti-Muslim, and your support for Israel? You have to choose between the two. Either you're going to evangelize Muslims and take every roadblock out of the way with Muslims, or you're going to support Israel, but you can't do both at the same time. The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Jerry Falwell says, look, he told Newsweek, we're going to be watching this roadmap very carefully. Why? They're going to be watching the roadmap very carefully because he believes that every last square inch of the ancient boundaries of Israel belong to Israel, national Israel, today by divine right, and that anything less is a compromise that's unacceptable. And look, if you're going to believe that every last square inch of the geographical boundaries of ancient Israel belong by divine right to the modern state of Israel, then be consistent and oppose the roadmap to peace, because it will involve giving up land. It does involve giving up land. There's no two ways about it. You know, you might have to choose between this president and Israel at some point, which would raise an interesting question about dual loyalty. I mean, if I said, that I was more concerned about what's good for, let's say, oh, I don't know, France, let's just say I really like the French. But if I said, look, I am more concerned about what's good for France than I am than what's good for America. You would say, well, that's just borderline treason. Americans ought to be concerned about what's good for America first and foremost, right? And yet there are Christian Zionists who come very close to, I won't say they do, but they come very close to saying, well, what's good for America is by definition what's good for Israel, period. So whether or not it brings peace in the Middle East or not, whether or not it furthers other foreign policy objectives in the Middle East that don't have anything to do with Israel, as though any of them did have nothing to do with Israel, it makes no difference. What's good for Israel is good for America, period. Now, if I just changed the name Israel for France, or for that matter, Portugal, what's good for Portugal is good for America. In foreign policy, you'd say, look, you got your priorities all mixed up. Story from the New York Times. On a recent Saturday in a church fellowship hall, evangelical Christians from several states gathered for an all-day seminar on how to woo Muslims away from Islam. The teacher urged a kindly approach. Always show Muslims love, charity, and hospitality, he said, and carry copies of the New Testament to give as gifts. The students, scribbling notes, included two pastors, a school secretary, and college students who said they hoped to convert Muslims in the United States or on mission trips abroad. But although the teacher, an evangelical preacher from Beirut, stressed the need to avoid offending Muslims, he projected a snappy PowerPoint presentation showing passages from the Quran that said, and he said that he had proved Islam was regressive, fraudulent, and violent. Here in the Quran, it says, slay them, slay the infidels, said the teacher, who said he did not want to be identified because a missionary to Muslims put his life at risk. Quote, in the Bible, there are no words from Jesus saying that we should kill innocent people. At the grassroots of evangelical Christianity, many are now absorbing the antipathy for Islam that emerged last year with the incendiary comments of ministers, the sharp language from religious leaders like Franklin Graham, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Jerry Vines, the former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, has drawn rebukes from Muslims and Christian groups alike. Mr. Graham called Islam a very evil and wicked religion, and Mr. Vines called Muhammad, Islam's founder and prophet, a demon-possessed pedophile. In evangelical churches and seminaries across the country, lectures and books criticizing Islam and promoting strategies for Muslim conversions are gaining currency. More than a dozen recently published books as critiques of Islam are now available in Christian bookstores. The story goes on to wonder whether or not these two are compatible. A negative view of Islam and the desire to convert them to Christianity. What do you think? I've been publicly supportive of Franklin Graham's assessment of Islam. And yet, I sincerely desire that Muslims would hear the gospel. Are those two things incompatible? I think your religion has at its very roots an inclination toward oppression of people, a failure to distinguish between church and state to such a degree that this religion that is essentially a big set of rules leads to the downfall of civilizations? I mean, I think that's what Franklin Graham meant when he said repressive and evil. Can I believe that and also say that I want the Muslim to be saved when he hears the gospel of Jesus Christ? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I don't know, someone looking in from the outside might say that Christian evangelicals have two strikes against them when it comes to the Muslims. First of all, they think, if you're going to believe the New York Times, they think that Islam is an evil religion across the board, and they also support Israel uncritically. It's a wonder Muslims are ever converted. What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines. For people of faith, the Bible can serve as a compass to help navigate life's dilemmas, from questions to spirituality to everyday problems with relationships or work. But one jury took that too far when they thumbed through the Bible during deliberations to find passages on the death penalty, said a Colorado judge. Friday's decision to throw out the death sentence has left some experts wondering where to draw the line. Quote, most people during life and death events rely on to some extent on their religion, said the former Denver prosecutor Craig Silverman. Some question whether the banning of the Bible from jury deliberations is wise or even feasible, considering how ingrained the Bible's teachings can be for those who spend years learning them. I think that the Bible is kind of the root of who I am, said Jan Polzin, 51. She said this before Sunday services at Grace Church in Westminster, Colorado. Any decision I make, the Bible would be the foundation, whether it's work, day-to-day, or on a jury. Judge John Virgil's decision is one of a handful in the last two decades to overturn death penalty sentences because the judges considered the Bible to be illegal outside reference material used by juries. You don't ask jurors to set aside their personal beliefs, but they can't be going outside sources, and I think they mean outside the law itself, in making decisions, said the Kansas State District Judge David Kennedy. He ordered a new sentencing in a 2000 case of a man convicted in the slaying of a Wichita couple after at least two Bibles were brought into the deliberation room. Some jurors told the judge that they had referred to a passage reading, "If a person does not ask for mercy, they may not be granted mercy." I don't know of this passage. That is the oddest quotation I've ever heard. Suggesting that the suspect never asked for mercy, therefore he should receive the death penalty. Now, it's not enough that they bring the Bible into the jury room, but they misquote it in order to make their decision? Oh my goodness. Let's go to the phones. Mike is calling from his car. Welcome to Issues Etc., Mike.
Thank you. I was just going to make a comment. I don't know how related this is to it, but it's just kind of interesting that a lot of the same evangelicals who think that Israel has a divine right to that land also think that about America when the founding of this country happened. It's kind of a divine right there as well, and yet we displaced the Native Americans to have that divine right. So I guess it's okay if you're on the right side of that divine right, but if you're not. And so it's just, I don't know if that's related, but it just seemed to me kind of a little bit hypocritical, maybe.
Mike, thank you for the call. You know, he brought up something that I've brought up before as well, and that is, look, you will hear people, especially Christians, my fellow Christians, from time to time say that America is a Christian nation. And why? Well, the founders of this nation were Christian. Okay, let's allow that for the moment. That's a tough case to make, by the way, considering the religious practices of some of the founders. Not all of them, but some of them. But let's allow that for a moment. They weren't the first people here, though. In fact, if you want to get really strict about it, as far as we can tell from history, the original inhabitants of this land, who did form themselves into nations, not modern nations, but nations of peoples, with whom we later signed treaties, and if they're not nations, you don't sign treaties with them, they were not Christian. They were animists, spiritists. These were the religions of Native Americans. We used to call them Indians back in the old days. I mean, by the logic that people use to assert that America is a Christian nation because its original inhabitants were predominantly Christian, one might also argue that America is an animist or a spiritist nation because its original inhabitants before the Christians got here were in fact practicing those religions. Well, they weren't a country then why did we sign treaties with them? Treaties that are still on the books. Why do we still permit them to operate as sovereign nations within the boundaries of our country? Just something to think about. Of course, he makes the comparison to Israel and to its land claims there. The Christian Zionist is going to say, well, the land claims that modern Israel has upon the geography over there don't come from Israelis per se, but from God himself in the Old Testament. And that's all fine and true if you believe that the modern state of Israel is the same thing as the ancient nation of Israel, the people of God. That's a case that I don't think you could make theologically in light of what, well, for instance, people like Paul say in the book of Galatians. But when did theology ever get in the way of a good Zionist argument, good foreign policy? Matt's calling from Richmond Heights. Matt, welcome to Issues Etc. We've got just about a minute here before we go to our break.
Hello, Todd. I just recall reading not long ago that during America's colonial period that a number of states, I believe it was states, that required the parishioners be armed while attending church. And
To what purpose?
Well, you know, if it was on the frontier, Indian attacks, possibly, that type of thing. And I also wanted to ask if anyone, does anyone believe that by, you know, making gun possession illegal on church grounds, that people attending Sunday school and sermons would be safer? And that question is asked because it's my understanding that only law-abiding citizens obey the law, by definition. And so that raises the question, then, why should terrorists or mentally ill murderers have free rein shooting innocent people at will without an appropriate response?
Matt, before I let you go here, and really we have just a few seconds, do you believe that gun ownership or gun control is a specifically biblical Christian issue? Beyond the Constitution?
Well, yes. Being permitted to own a sword, that's equivalent to today's firearm rifle. The sword of 2,000 years ago is equivalent to the rifle or the handgun today.
All right, Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd.
You know, I can understand if you are afraid of Indian attack, why you would ask people to be armed when you're getting people together in a large group, like Sunday morning on the frontier. I can understand that completely. Now, are you safer on Sunday morning if people can't carry their guns into church? I want you to consider for a moment, people, Sunday morning and what Christians say they want to have happen on Sunday morning. What do we want to have happen on Sunday morning? We want sinners to come in. We want the ex-con to come in. We want the prostitute to come in. We want the degenerate to come in and hear about Jesus, right? There's also a good argument to be made that we would ask them not to carry their guns in when they do. We'll be right back and talk more about that after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Darwinism, pantheism, utopianism, postmodernism. There are many popular worldviews today. Some are obvious, some are not, but all whittle away at the Christian faith. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Join me and Issues Etc. regular guests, Craig Parton, Rolf Preuss, George Mather, and Angus Manoosh for a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar June the 20th through the 27th at the Marvin M. Schwann Retreat and Conference Center in Trago, Wisconsin. Now, a reasonable registration fee covers the seminar, 7 nights lodging, and all your meals. For more information on a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June the 20th through the 27th in northern Wisconsin, call the Schwann Center at 1-800-577-4848, 1-800-577-4848, or check out our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar.
Dinosaurs, now are they proof of evolution?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the book, The Great Dinosaur Mystery Solved. Well, did dinosaurs really exist? I've heard, Ken, that some Christians think they're a hoax.
Well, dinosaurs are real. I remember after I'd preached in a church in Australia and was in the pastor's car once, the pastor's son piped up and said, "Hey, Dad, how come you told us dinosaurs never existed?" "Quiet, son," said the pastor. You see, because the pastor thought that dinosaurs and evolution went hand in hand, and that Christians didn't have answers to explain dinosaurs, he just told his son they didn't exist. But what happens when you take your son to a large museum and you see the bones of these creatures? Obviously, they did exist. But you know, they aren't such a mystery, and they can easily be explained on the basis of the Bible. In fact, I believe the Bible talks more about dinosaurs than most other animals. You see, the word dinosaur was first used in 1841. Now, the King James Version of the Bible was translated into English in 1611. That's why you don't find the word dinosaur in that Bible. Before these creatures were named dinosaurs, though, they were called dragons. And that word occurs a number of times in the Old Testament. Yes, dinosaurs did exist, and not so long ago.
So were dinosaurs on Noah's Ark? For the evidence, read Ken Ham's fascinating booklet on dinosaurs. It's available free on our website, AnswersRadio.com. Our site's attractive and very easy to use. Log on to AnswersRadio.com.
It's 5:31. We'll continue with open lines of issues, etc. coming up here in about a minute. AM 850 KFUO weather clear tonight, 58 for the overnight low. A chance of showers tomorrow, maybe thunderstorm. Tomorrow's high 77, 78 now with sunshine. In traffic, eastbound 270 between McDonald Boulevard and 170, there's slow traffic. Northbound 270 between Dorset Road and 70, heavy traffic, mostly in the right lanes. Northbound 170 between North Hanley and 270, slow traffic there. Eastbound 40 between Maryville Center and Mason, expect slow traffic. Northbound 55 after 44, there's slow traffic in the right lane heading towards the Poplar Street Bridge. And eastbound 40 between Jefferson and the Poplar Street Bridge, there's slow traffic there.
AM 850 KFUO salutes our day sponsors on this Tuesday, May 27th, 2003, Ken and Brenda Wagoner. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in honor and gratitude to God for daughter Alyssa's 10th birthday. Once again, we say thank you to Ken and Brenda Wagoner of St. Louis, today's AM 850 KFUO Day sponsors, and best wishes to Alyssa for a very happy birthday.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., the Gospel of Social Action. In the Episcopal Church USA, our guest will be Joyce Milton of National Review Online. We'll also talk to Dr. Angus Manouge of Concordia University in Wisconsin about postmodernism and hypersecularism. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. Now, it's open lines for the next 25 minutes of the program, the final 25 minutes of the program today. So if you're going to call, call now, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We are coming to you live this Tuesday, May the 27th, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Matt called before the break, and he anticipated something I said I would talk about. So here it is from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. The headline reads, "Churches Scramble, Fret Over Gun Law." A woman returning a call from the Al-Taqwa Mosque in St. Paul was puzzled when asked about a new state law that allows people with permits to carry guns in, among other places, mosques and other houses of worship. "What country are you talking about?" The response could well have come from any church, synagogue, or mosque in Minnesota before a lawsuit was filed Tuesday by Edina Community Lutheran Church. The church maintains that the state's new conceal and carry gun law infringes on the guarantee of religious freedom under the Constitution because it requires the church to, among other things, allow guns in its parking lot. Calls pouring in from other churches and synagogues, said David Lilly Hogg, an attorney who filed the suit on behalf of the Edina Church. Soon after, Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Minneapolis joined in. "It's been astonishing," he said. "Clearly, a very deep chord has been struck. Interested religious organizations will be added as plaintiffs on May the 28th, the date the law takes effect. Lily Hogg said. But many congregations aren't ready to make that decision. This has taken us off guard, said the Reverend Doug Donnelly of the University Baptist Church in Minneapolis. He and others at church are discussing their options. The conceal and carry bill was passed last month and takes effect Wednesday this week. It does raise it. I mean, that's a legitimate question, right? A church, if the law says that the parking lot of the church is a place where someone with a permit can carry a gun, the church does have to say, how are we going to react to this? There's a related story here, also from the Star Tribune. This involves one David Gross, a former Minneapolis assistant city attorney, now in private practice. He says that Rabbi Norman Cohen of Bet Shalom in Minnetonka knows that he brings a gun to the synagogue. He brings a gun to the synagogue, including on high holidays. Gross has a Florida permit to carry a gun because of threats to his life when he was a Minneapolis prosecutor. And then another story that followed that. Churches must follow a two-step process to keep guns out. This is dated just a couple days ago. What does a church have to do to make sure guns don't get in? The same as any other non-governmental organization, according to David Goldstein, a lawyer in Minneapolis. Private establishments such as churches, Target Center, the Guthrie Theater, office buildings, department stores, and restaurants must notify the public of the gun ban. Goldstein outlined the two-step process under the law. We're actually talking in Minneapolis and Minnesota about, I'm going up there pretty soon. At least I'll be driving through. I should be careful. Maybe I should bring my gun. I don't have a permit, though, to carry it. I mean, I got a permit to own it, but not to carry it or have it concealed. Here's the two-step process under the current law in Minneapolis. You must post at every entrance, and this applies to churches in particular, an 11 by 17 inch sign that says the name of the establishment bans guns on these premises. The lettering must be black Arial typeface, at least 1.5 inches high. The signs must be within 4 lateral feet of the door and between 4 to 6 feet from the floor. You must personally notify every person who enters of the ban. However, because remember, under the conceal and carry law in Minnesota, you can carry it in unless they tell you you can't. However, there is no guidance as to what personally notify means. A general announcement over the public address system may or may not satisfy the law. Can you imagine this? You go to, let's say you're just a Methodist and you go to the United Methodist Church on the corner up in Minneapolis, and there's a sign outside, right outside the front, that says this establishment bans guns on the premises. And then when you get in there, according to the law established there in Minnesota, they must announce to you in some form, either when the greeter shakes your hands. Oh, by the way, do you have any firearms with you? We don't permit. Did you see the sign outside? You can't bring your gun in here, please. Or perhaps the pastor would just begin the service with a polite announcement. You know, some churches begin with the polite announcement, please turn off your beepers and cell phones. And if you're carrying any of your firearms, please hand them to an usher and he will secure them in our gun locker. You can retrieve them at the end of the service. With proper signs and personal notification, what happens if a person enters with a gun? The lawyer continues. Oh, I guess you could just pass the offering plate, couldn't you? They'd get pretty heavy pretty quick, depending on how many people are carrying guns into church. If a person enters with a gun, you can demand that he or she leave. Now, this does thwart the purpose of church. Maybe he's one of those sinners, one of those ex-cons. Maybe he's even a lawbreaker, a felon who hasn't been caught. Maybe he's coming to meet Jesus. Or, if the individual refuses, you can call the police. This is not a joke, folks. It's true. You can call the police if you spot a gun. You might not know if the person has a permit, Although a permit must be carried, it needs to be shown to a police officer. If the permit carriers don't have permits, I'm sorry, if the permitted carrier does not have a permit, they can show it later that they were authorized to carry the gun at the time, avoiding a fine for not having the permit. The police will take the make the person leave the premises. The police can also issue a ticket that carries a $25 fine. The gun and the permit are not forfeited. All right. Again, I will say this. As an owner of a gun, and one who enjoys the use of guns recreationally, this is not a Christian issue. It's not an exercise of your religious freedom to carry a gun. It is your exercise of Second Amendment freedoms. What do I mean? I mean this. There is no scripture from which I can say, thus saith the Lord, on, say, the Brady Bill or any other gun bill. I can argue against those bills on the basis of the U.S. Constitution, in particular the Second Amendment. That's where my argument ought to lie, not from the Bible. I can't say, thus saith the Lord. I can't say, thus saith the Constitution. Let's go to Roland. He's calling from South City. Roland, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, how you doing?
Doing well.
Where to start today? First, it strikes me that's probably a poorly written law. In what was it, Minnesota?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I've been active in the concealed carry campaign in the state of Missouri and have participated in some of the legislative, the writing sessions.
Well, then let me ask you this before you go on.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you think that a conceal and carry law, say, in Missouri, ought to say that you can, with a permit, carry your gun, except into church on Sunday morning? That would be one of the places they wouldn't want you carrying it. Would that be a reasonable curtailing of our rights to keep and bear arms? To say, just don't, okay, folks, I know you need to carry a gun, but leave it in the glove compartment of the car, or leave it, I don't know, hid in the bush, whatever you want to do, leave it with the kids at home. Don't bring it to church.
Well, I am sort of a libertarian at heart, though I'm not a hardcore libertarian, and I would say so long as that law applies evenly, then I wouldn't have a problem with that restriction. But you have to understand, where I go to church, there are guns in my parish every Sunday and at every Saturday evening service. Do you know why?
I don't know. Liturgical target practice?
No. We have police officers who are members of our congregation.
Mm-hmm. Now, they are required by law to carry a firearm.
Not necessarily. It depends upon your jurisdiction. That's not uniform. And, you know, off-duty carry is not necessarily a requirement. Plus, I would add this, that a weapon can be secured inside their vehicle while they're inside the church. And it's at their disposal should they have to get in their vehicle to go on a call to respond to an event.
Oh, absolutely. I'm all in favor.
So, if you apply the law evenly, but you know what? I am no more and no less dangerous than a police officer who could also be a wife beater or an alcoholic or a drug. I mean, you know, sin and addiction permeate society at all levels.
Well, let me ask you this, Roland.
Yeah.
And at the risk of just sounding incredibly naive in this dangerous world we live in, why would you need to carry your gun into church?
Why?
Yeah.
Because leaving it in an unsecured vehicle where someone could break in and get it and then convert that weapon into a illegal firearm in the possession of a questionable individual, the only time a firearm is absolutely safe is when it is in one of two places, under my direct personal control, where I supervise it all the time, or locked away safely in my gun safe.
Well, then why don't you leave it in your gun safe on Sunday morning? Why would you need to take it to church?
Assuming I would.
Well, but
I never said I would take it to church. I'm just saying if the law were applied evenly, I wouldn't have a problem with it.
Why would anyone beyond, you mentioned the peace officers, that's great. I don't think anyone begrudges them the need. I think it's a need to be armed, given their role in our society that we have given them. Why would anyone beyond peace officers need to bring their gun to church?
Well, I have a simple answer for you.
Yeah.
It may seem naive, but a naive question. I'll respond in a naive way. Because police officers do not exist to prevent crime. 99% of the time, a police officer is responding after the fact. There are only two people, generally, at the scene of any crime, and that's going to be the victim and the perpetrator.
But you're in a church with, let's just say it's Sunday morning,
mm-hmm.
and there are lots of people there, including a smattering of police officers who are armed.
Yeah.
Why would, and let's say your situation is typical. Okay, let's just say for the sake of argument, your situation is typical then on a Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you or anyone else in that situation need to take their gun to church?
Well,
got the police officer there.
Once I'm in the church building, I feel perfectly secure, but, you know, it's a big bad world out there between my home and the church or wherever I may choose to go afterwards. And again, going back to the security issue, that weapon is only secure when it's in my immediate control. So if I'm going on to another destination after church and I'm not coming back home to retrieve it, then the safest place for it to be is not locked in the vehicle while I'm in church, but on my person. You know, what you have to understand, Todd, is that there are people today who have made a choice that they, you know, by definition are going to be lawbreakers because they choose personal defense. And if you're someone with two kids under five and a wife and you're traveling across country and you're in the middle of the Georgia or Florida countryside on an interstate highway at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, that's when you have to make the choice about what you're going to do that's important to you. Are you going to take care of the family and make sure they're safe, or are you going to be a good law-abiding citizen and basically become, you know, a mandated victim? I mean, the thing that has always cheesed me off about this is people blow raspberries at the Constitution, however you care to define what the Second Amendment does. But the thing that bothers me is, and I'll never forget this, I was sitting in an audience where Clarence Harmon, former mayor, former police chief of the city of St. Louis, was addressing a crowd about a variety of different issues while he was mayor. And one of the things he talked about was the first effort of this concealed carry bill that went on. And he was talking about the safest thing you can do is become a willing victim. When somebody approaches you and wants your wallet or wants to do something
but
to you or
Roland,
to your family,
Roland, okay, let me just, let's see if we can wrap this up. Is this, okay, Roland's gone. Look, I want you to notice something. With all due respect to Roland, we went from church to the middle of the countryside, 2 o'clock in the morning in Florida or Georgia. Did you hear that, folks? We went from church Sunday morning, surrounded by people who, at least in most congregations, try to act like they love you. Fellow Christians. To alone with my family in the middle of the Florida wilderness at 2 o'clock in the morning. Are these equivalents to one another? I mean, maybe the church's obligation goes beyond just allowing its members to carry guns in. Maybe they should, since it is such a dangerous world, immediately outside those church doors, maybe we ought to, maybe a little razor wire is in order and some armed guards. At least they could extend the perimeter of safety out to the church property. And if they had a kind of a drive-through underground parking lot, you could be relatively secure there, too. I mean, for heaven's sakes, I could see this being a big boon for the church growth movement, right? The most secure, we've got armed guards, the most, and when you bring your gun in, no one will trouble you. If you want to twirl it on the end of your finger during the sermon, go right ahead. After all, give the people what they want. When does it cross the line? You see, I understand the argument for being able to defend oneself and one's family. I understand that perfectly. I don't want to see my family get hurt. But isn't there a difference between someone who stands up and says, everyone should just be willing victims of crime, and the person who says, but you know, carrying a gun into church crosses a line. Is it either you're a patsy to every thug and criminal because you refuse to carry a gun? See, this seems to be the argument. If you're not in favor of conceal and carry, which it may surprise you folks, I'm in favor of it. But the reason I ask the question is because we obviously got to sort out the lines where I can carry my gun and where I can't. as though we can magically look into people's hearts and say, well, because they gave him a permit, he's obviously not a felon. How many people are killed every year using guns they own legally? Or kill others with guns that they own legally? It happens, doesn't it? Just because the guy has a permit doesn't mean he isn't dangerous to me or my family. I'm sitting in church on Sunday. If I see a guy when he crosses his leg during the sermon, I see he's got a ankle holster with a gun in it. Call me a commie if you want to. I don't care. But I'm not going to feel that much safer. Oh, by the way, you don't need to use a gun. There's a story here, and especially if you're Lutheran, there's a story here. All you got to use is the coffee. I'll get to that before we're done. It's a great way to end. Kathy's calling from St. Charles. Kathy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. I just had heard your last conversation, and there was an incident here not too long ago in our country where there was a shooting in church, and I just didn't hear you either one of you or your guest or your caller that just called bring that up, but there was, you know, an incident where there was a shooting in the church. I guess it was in Texas somewhere. Someone had gone in on a Wednesday night and shot up some youth activity. So, I mean, it does happen even in church.
Oh, sure it does, Kathy, and there's no doubt about that. The question is the answer to let all the parishioners carry their own guns? Let me put it to you this way. This doesn't apply just to churches. It applies to synagogues and mosques, too. Should the Muslims in your neighborhood be able to carry loaded guns concealed on their persons into their mosque on Friday night? I mean, if you can carry it in on Sunday morning, they should be carried in there, too, right? You know, they're not preaching the gospel there at the mosque. They might even be preaching some invective against Western values or invective against perhaps even the infidel. Would you feel safer in a mosque filled with Muslim men who are all concealing and carrying? Because it doesn't just apply to churches. Well, you don't need a gun. This is New Sweden, Maine. This is a story from my birthday, in fact. Investigators say that they are convinced at least two people were behind the deadly arsenic poisoning at a small church, and they have narrowed the list to a possible list of suspects from six to ten parishioners. Can't tell who did it. The conspirators may have been trying to poison the church's 12-member council, perhaps in a disagreement over plans to consolidate the church with a neighboring congregation. One man died and 15 others were sickened from drinking tainted coffee after a Sunday service on April 27th. 5 days later, a longtime worshiper, Daniel Bonson, 53, shot himself to death and left a suicide note that convinced investigators he was involved in the poisonings and may not have acted alone. Investigators have since uncovered information substantiating their belief that the crime involved at least two members of the church. We're very comfortable with the fact that Daniel Bondenson didn't act alone because of the things we've learned in the last week, said one of the officers. We strongly feel that someone in the community helped Daniel Bondenson, helped, conspired with, planned to commit this act. Appleton, who is the chief investigator here, is leading the homicide investigation. He would not elaborate on the new information, but in an interview he spoke more openly than ever about potential suspects, their possible motives and intended victims, and their theories about the case. The congregation has about 50 regular churchgoers, and investigators have concluded that at least 40 of them were not involved in the poisonings. But he described a group of 6 to 10 people who are still considered potential suspects. I certainly hope that any co-conspirators are within that group we're looking at. I think when we're all through, the group's going to be a lot smaller. Investigators believe that the poisonings that rocked the farming community occurred when seemingly innocuous small-town church politics turned combustible. I don't know if church is that safe of a place for people to be carrying guns. I mean, the callers say, oh, I feel safe in church. I don't know. I don't feel that safe in church. A bunch of sinners in there, including me. We're sitting cheek to jowl with one another. And the pastor up there is saying rather provocative things. He's accusing us of things like being sinners and actually sinning. He's even admitting to doing it himself. And then he goes on to describe horrific acts of violence perpetrated on an innocent man and the shedding of blood and a death. Is that why you go to church on Sunday morning, to exercise your right to carry your gun? And if there's one place we can leave it at home, no matter where you stand on conceal and carry, wouldn't it be God's house, where God's word is of highest priority? I don't know, maybe I'm being naive. And no matter where you stand on gun control, everybody's got a line someplace. Everybody's got a line someplace they want drawn. The fact of the matter is, the world is as dangerous in the church as it is outside the church. I wonder what it says in general. Of our faith in God, allowing for the fact that God permits self-defense, that we would feel that because we've got the loaded gun in our possession, we're just that much safer. It gives me comfort to have this gun at my side. It gives me a sense of safety, a sense of security. When all the while, maybe we might, and they're in church, when all the while we're missing what gives real security and real safety. It's what that pastor's up there preaching. He's preaching the message of sin and grace, of our sin and Christ's death for us. There's real security. There's real safety. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.